hand, the actual true people that I've found who are my friends, the ones that actually help us survive, there are such beautiful, wonderful Russians. That is the really, I consider, the redeeming foundational power of Russia is the decency of just normal people.
Given that you've gone through this process, would you encourage other Westerners to move to Russia?
I'd say a year ago I would, despite the problems I was having. But right now, there have been some very serious changes in the economics.
As of spring 2026, Russia's wartime economy is under significant strain, with high inflation and continuing pressure from Western sanctions. The government has responded with tax rises, including an increase in VAT, something Leo says is making life harder for small businesses, before he moves on to more political concerns.
I'm also concerned that the censorship systems are rising up. Russia blocks Western sources. They have these different laws, like in some cases they say it's illegal to like surf the internet for what's termed subversive material. I mean, what's that? Whatever they want it to be that day. You know, the freedom of information, the freedom of speech, basic human freedoms are being manipulated and channelized into what I would call a digital gulag. And this is what Russians tell me. This is just not me criticizing Russia.
We're obviously having this conversation while you're in Russia, and you are freely telling me your opinions.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel able to freely express what you think there, or is part of you worried about repercussions, especially because you were originally held up as this model family?
You know, here's a reason I don't fear repercussions, not because they couldn't come, but because I value truth more than I value my life. I've always been an open book. I've always been straightforward. I've never received a penny or a dime, not from a Western news source like yourself or from the Kremlin. In fact, I know officials. I have a regular relationship with them. And they're probably like watching over me or something. I don't really care.
Given how things have turned out, I ask Leo if he'd consider going back to America.
I could go back at any time. All I have to do is buy a ticket, take my passport, and I'm gone. That's not a problem, but I don't really believe that's my divine calling, if you will. I think I'm supposed to stay here and remain with the people I've chosen to remain with.
Does part of you miss America?
Yeah, I do actually miss America. I miss the freedoms that have shaped the American personality. Russia, you don't have these human rights values. It's more of a, I would say, just a feudalistic culture that's been kind of modernized. They're very heavily dependent on like leaders to kind of define what they should and shouldn't think.
Do you think you'll still be in Russia in a year's time?
I believe I will. That's just my gut instinct.
Leo's directness about the pros and cons of life in Russia is highly unusual coming from a self-described moral migrant. Many of the people promoting Russia online as a destination for disgruntled Westerners give an entirely rosy picture. But someone else trying to present a more balanced perspective is Ben from Derby in the United Kingdom. He relocated to Kursk in Western Russia, close to the Ukraine border, in 2023.
Welcome to Russia, specifically the city of Kursk, my home city.
He made a YouTube video with what he admits is the slightly clickbaity title, The Truth About Living in Russia. Ben isn't on the shared values visa. His reason for moving was more personal.
So I met my now wife on a language exchange website and fell in love with her, ended up marrying her, and moved to Russia.
How did your friends and family react when you said you're going to Russia?
At first they thought I was mad. It happened around the time that things started with Ukraine, and so they thought I was a bit insane for going there and it was dangerous and...
Did that bother you, going to a country that was now at war with its neighbour?
When I first went, there was some fighting in the Kursk region. And so you did get quite regular strikes on the city. You get the sirens going off occasionally and rocket alerts.
At that point, did you think, oh, actually, am I really making the right decision here?
Well, I wanted to be with my wife, so I can put up with that.
Ben tells me there are pros and cons of living in Russia. On the positive side, he says Russians are very friendly, especially if you speak their language, and he feels safer day to day, something I'd heard from several expats. The downsides include lower wages and the difficulty of renting a property if you're not Russian. Ben says he started his YouTube channel to give a sense of what life is really like for a Westerner in Russia.
Do you feel able to speak very freely, or do you feel that there's things you'd think twice about saying on that channel?
I think I can speak openly about the challenges of life. Obviously, I don't want to touch politics with a 6-foot barge pole. But in general, I think the biggest issues with it will be when you actually post it and you have people online debating it rather than the authorities themselves. There's been some rather mean comments about me.
From people living where?
Living in the West. People who don't particularly like Russia's politics, and so they take it out on me for moving. A lot of comments about wishing to see me turn into red mist, or wanting to see me in the newest drone footage from the front. There's comments about my wife as well, but I won't discuss them, and they're quite difficult to read, yeah.
Does it make you want to stop doing the online vlogging?
Yeah, I'll be honest, yeah, it does.
Last year, Ben made a YouTube video specifically about the shared values visa, which is how I came across him.
Now, many people believe that Russia is some kind of conservative paradise, and it's the last bastion of moral, religious values in Europe. I would personally say that is not entirely the truth.
He says he wanted to correct the misconception that Russia is some kind of conservative paradise.
It's not really. For example, there's a prevalence of single-parent households and abortion being very widely accepted and divorce rates in many regions being extremely high.
Ben is right about these contradictions. So is Russia really a conservative utopia? Well, it depends a bit on what you mean by conservative. Russian society is certainly more traditional than much of the West, with a strong emphasis on family, religion, and national identity. But that's not quite the same as the conservatism many Westerners might think of, one that also places a high value on individual freedom and political choice.
Do you think anyone who comes on this visa ends up being surprised that it's not this very conservative society?
I've come across people who have been surprised. They're not normally the ones making videos.
Ben's video soon caught the attention of other online influencers. Some pro-Ukraine accounts said Ben's video was proof that life for Westerners in Russia is a nightmare. Those supporting Russia said that wasn't what Ben was saying at all.
What was the experience like for you seeing people taking your video and spinning their own narratives out of it?
At times I didn't like it, because obviously no one likes words being put in their mouth. But in general, I mean, it got me 3,000 subscribers. That's a plus, I guess.
3,000 is very respectable, but there are obviously now people, Westerners in Russia, some of them have very big followings.
Yeah.
And I just wondered what you make of the wider YouTube community, these Russia content creators.
It is hit or miss, obviously, like any community. But I do think there are some people with some kind of agenda that they want to push. I don't personally like that. I think there's some wrong incentives in there with some people.
I ask Ben what he means by this. He doesn't want to name names, but feels that some YouTubers might be incentivized, he doesn't say by whom, to promote a certain image of Russia.
I have been talking to some other of these YouTubers of people that live in Russia, and they have been approached, and they've been quite open telling me about that. They get the travel paid for to these places and showing off something that they want them to show off, but it's not even exactly, you film this and we'll pay you money for it. It's more a roundabout way until you kind of get into that ecosystem, and then eventually it ends up where you might be told exactly what they want you to film.
And if someone came to you and said, Ben, there's a lot of money sitting on the table here, can you make a video, but we want to shape the narrative of it, what would you say?
I don't know if I can say this on the air, but I'd tell them to bog off.
It's been almost 2 years since Russia's shared values visa was introduced. So has it been a success? It's certainly made it easier for some Westerners to build new lives in the country, whether for love, faith, or a change of direction. But a bigger wave of anti-woke immigration has not materialised. And those seeking some kind of conservative utopia in Russia may find that the reality is quite different from the dream. You've been listening to The Documentary with me, Dan Hardoon. The Russian Dream is a Story Squared production for the BBC World Service.
Welcome to Stockport. Pull up a piece of refurbished precinct. We've been wasting council money since 1963. This is Stockport, hub of industry, where pubs become nurseries and the streets are paved with puns from Robinson's Brewery. We're the wrong side of the Pennines, but the right side of the Mersey. Suburbia is calling to those who want to listen. Where drinking starts at four in your mother's prefab kitchen. So meet me by the viaduct and I'll let you take my picture with the camera that you stole from your old sixth form teacher. Welcome to Stockport, spiritual home of universally low self-esteem. Twee, industrial history, and poverty, safaris. Although we're quietly optimistic, raise these kids on McVitie's biscuits. Just frustrated ambition and resistance to cold. I can't come out Friday night cause my brother's got my coat and suburbia is calling to those who want to listen. Where drinking starts at four in your mother's prefab kitchen. So meet me by the viaduct and I'll let you take my picture with the camera that you stole from your old sixth form teacher. Seven miles south of town, run down red brick, kick the shit out of strangers, though strangeness sustains us. This is suburbia calling. Suburbia is calling to those who want to listen. Where drinking starts at four in your mother's prefab kitchen. So meet me by the viaduct and I'll let you take my picture with the camera that you stole from your old sixth form teacher.
The number you have reached, 363-9999, is not in service. If you feel you have reached this recording in error, please check the number and dial again. Thank you. Bye.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi.
Out in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
You do. Good evening.
Well, what an incredible week this has been. kind of a sports-themed week, I guess. But, boy, New York has really seen some history made with the victory of the Knicks last Saturday and the massive parade that's going to be taking place in the basically in downtown Manhattan tomorrow. And that's going to be something worth remembering, worth experiencing perhaps. And of course, we have the World Cup happening all over the country, all over three countries actually. And of course, we had the charade that happened in Washington on Sunday. But maybe we shouldn't talk about that at all. You guys have any thoughts, any experiences? I know you guys are in the city proper, so maybe had some firsthand experiences.
Well, we're in New Jersey for a bar mitzvah, and we sat in bumper-to-bumper traffic to get back to New York from New Jersey. And there were all the signs that said, oh, are you going to the World Cup? Take public transit. Take New Jersey Transit. And I was busy yelling at all the signs we saw on the highway saying, you can't do that. They won't let you do that. Stop suggesting that. That's a bad idea. This is the thing I don't understand. We've discussed this many, many times. I'm not a sports person. I don't understand sports fandom. I don't understand why people were busy hitting school buses with crowbars after the Knicks won. I don't understand why people got stabbed in the celebration after the Knicks won. I'm fascinated by the fact that Scotland has apparently drunk Boston out of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
There's no alcohol in Boston right now because that's where Scotland is based.
Yeah, and we've been trying to do that for a long time, and they succeeded in finally draining Boston dry.
As a non-fan, I'm not anti... No, I'm not a sports fan. So I feel like I've been on another planet this whole week. People are in shockingly good moods, which is nice to see. But at the same time, it's just something that is so completely foreign to me that I just feel like the whole city is speaking a language I don't understand.
Well, you know, it's not that hard to understand because basically when something happens that hasn't happened in a long time, people celebrate. And it turns out the Knicks just captured our imagination, I suppose. It's like, you know, when the Mets occasionally win something, they seem to be the underdogs. They seem to be the team that... I can't quite get it right, and when they do get it right, and they get it right in an amazing way, like they have done in the past few series that they've played. I mean, being behind by a huge margin, and then just coming back game after game in the fourth quarter, it's pretty magical. And you know, people are looking for something to bring them together in these times when we're so eager to be at each other's throats. And whenever you have huge, huge crowds of people, and there were, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not more, people in the streets, you're going to have idiots. You're absolutely going to have idiots, whether, you know, it's a social justice march, a sporting event, a political rally, whatever. You are going to have people who misbehave. Now, it's a mistake, I think, to categorize an entire event based on the actions of a few. Let me compare that to what happened on Sunday in Washington, D.C., which I said I don't want to talk about, but here we go. The majority of people were acting like idiots, and that's different. You know, that's kind of the theme is, yes, come here and be an idiot, and that's something where you have to comment on. But in the case of the Knicks, in case of the World Cup, people are coming together and just being positive and being diverse and just being happy. And I think that's something, even if you're not a sports fan, it should be familiar. It should be something we celebrate. It should be something we encourage. I don't really see any problem with it. The World Cup especially It is such a beautiful thing. It really is, to see all these people from different parts of the world who are able to make it into our country. And, you know, we'll talk about the people who didn't, which is, you know, an embarrassment. But, for instance, the Japanese fans in Texas who stayed after and cleaned up the stadium. I mean, you know, these incredible customs that get shared at times like this. And that's something to celebrate. That's something to be happy to be a part of. Yes, Kyle.
Well, I also think it's an opportunity for places that might have been feeling like it's impossible to travel to the U.S. that it actually is, and people that are totally committed to following their teams are going to make their way and travel and spend time in the U.S. regardless of what the climate is politically or how people feel about it economically. You know, they just made it work, you know, and they're really do it, you know, at whatever cost, doing it to make this event, to go to the games, to be a part of things. And they are contributing to a lot of the local economies and visiting places and exploring and commenting on life here, and they're going to take that back to their networks and share about, you know, what America's like these days.
Yeah, you know, there's something about seeing the just the amazement in people's eyes who are seeing something that you're familiar with for the very first time. We host an event in New York City, and it's magical to see people come to Manhattan and just experience it in a way that they never thought they could. And hopefully we're helping in that regard. Hopefully we're all helping to see that in the eyes of fans all throughout the three countries that are hosting the World Cup. That is something that I think we should all be celebrating, something we should all be encouraging.
And something we notice when we travel places, go to events overseas, mm-hmm. just how interesting and nice and welcoming and accommodating, hospitable people are. Well, the same could be true and is occurring as we speak with a lot of these visitors here. So hopefully they're bringing that impression back to, balance out some of the other stuff they're hearing about us lately.
And, you know, to see the happiness in the underdogs when they score and the fans. For instance, Cape Verde, am I pronouncing it right? Place,
yeah.
I didn't even know where it was, and I'm not going to tell you where it is, but it's one of the tiniest places ever to qualify for this competition. They played Spain. You might have heard of them. And they held them, a spoiler alert a couple of days ago, they held them to a tie. You know,
unbelievable.
Can you imagine what that means to people who live there? And you know, so few people live there in comparison. I mean, I think the number of people in the stadium was a good percentage of the number of people in their country.
The strong showings against these powerhouse teams and national teams, it's just right out of the gate, you have these really dramatic games, one after the other. Usually, you'd think that comes, you know, later in the rounds where you got stiff competition. These are great teams all the way around, it looks mm-hmm. like.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And, you know, to see a real spoiler right here, because it's today's game, to see the Democratic Republic of Congo score against Portugal and Ronaldo and hold them to a tie today, that was one of the happiest moments that country has experienced in quite a long time. To see all the fans in Houston, Texas reacting to that, that's one of those moments you just can't predict. It just happens. It's part of that magic. Yes, Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, speaking of traveling and whatnot, if you recall, I was in Spain last week, and I got back to New York Saturday night, back to my apartment, and there was 9 minutes left in the Knicks game. And as I was heading down 7th Avenue, I was just, you know, amazed at how many people were out on the streets. So I ran up the several flights of stairs that I have to run up to get to my apartment, threw my bags in, went back down to 7th Avenue. And like Gila, I'm not really a sports fan at all. I don't watch this stuff. I don't really even, you know the rules of basketball and all that well. But I felt like I wanted to be part of this thing going on in the street. So I'm part of this crowd, and the crowd started to get bigger and bigger and bigger to the point where it was just hundreds of people outside this bar on 15th Street in the West Village. I guess it's technically Chelsea right there. And it was pretty extraordinary. I mean, there was 9 minutes left in the game, right? But that took almost an hour to play out, given all of the timeouts and the commercial breaks and the penalties and all of these various things. And then ultimately when the Knicks won, it was total bedlam. I mean, people were going crazy, screaming, climbing on cars, climbing on poles. It was pretty amazing. It was great to see. Everybody was really, really happy. But I had this feeling, you know, that spidey sense, that feeling that you get in your spine, like, okay, I think I need to go home now because things are going to get a little bit out of hand. And I was watching this from the window of my apartment. It was just totally crazy. But I think that, you know, part of it is possibly, like most things, like most ills in the world today, I think a lot of it you can blame on social media, to kind of bring it back to the framing of this program here, right, where you get people acting out in crowds, trying to be the person who gets the most attention on them, trying to be the coolest person that they can post some kind of stupid reel or something on social media. But I think there's a lot of reasons for why people do this. I think that in crowds too, especially when there's something like this and the crowds are this big, that you have this diffused sense of accountability, right? So nobody's really the main character in the particular crowd. So you have this notion of risk taking that begins to spike as well. But then from another perspective, the whole notion of sports already frames the struggle as the world against whatever the team is, right? And then that kind of spills into this notion of real-world tribal behavior that you begin to see out on the streets. And this was a massive tribe in New York celebrating. It was a happy day. I'm not saying that, you know, there was anything overtly primitive about this, but it was a very, very tribal thing to see, and it was a cool thing to see. I was happy about it.
All right, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also not a sports person. I mean, thank you for mentioning that it was the Knicks who won, because I hadn't heard. But the whole idea of a fandom is something that I understand very well. I don't care about sports, but, you know, every time Doctor Who beats the Daleks, I'm out there turning over taxi cabs in celebration. But seriously, the thing that I'm thinking about is, I have, over the course of my life in the city, enjoyed going out to things like, you know, spontaneous street parties, unauthorized happenings, raves, things of that sort that you used to see a lot more of back in, like, the 90s, 2000s. And they always had this element of, like, we're all going to go out and do something and, you know, an element of danger behind it. But it was like everyone who was there for the experience. And that could be a lot of fun. And, you know, when people acted responsibly, it was. But over the years, as social media has taken more of a hold, there has been this element to things like that. And I include even protests in this sort of thing, where people go in there. There is a significant portion of the people who are now there not to experience it, but to show people that they were there and to get clips and, you know, videos and things to post online after. And so... I think there is more of an element of, like, let's spark something idiotic, so we'll have that footage of the idiotic thing, and we can say we were there. And it's I think something might have been lost there, in the sense of just going out and doing something fun and doing something weird with your local community.
I don't know. You know, I think people have always had a contingent of idiots in massive crowds. I don't think you need social media for that. Maybe social media makes it a bit worse, makes it a bit more viral. But I don't think it's the cause. I think that's just who we are when we gather in massive crowds. You know, that said, the massive crowds that formed in the streets of New York, and we'll see what happens tomorrow, I don't think it was, I mean, yeah, it's not good to burn school buses. I don't know what that was all about, but, it, you know, that was a minority of people, very, you know, small, and for the most part, 99%, if not more, it was peaceful. And when you consider how many people were in the streets and how jubilant everybody was, that's a good thing, you know. And I don't think it matters if you're a sports fan or not. This is about humanity. This is about people having a moment. And we certainly had a few moments over the past week that deserve to be acknowledged. And perhaps we can learn from them. Perhaps we can have more happy moments together in various contexts, whether or not we're experts or connoisseurs of the particular thing that's being celebrated. it's just important not to ignore it, not to condemn it, not to think you're above it, but to try and understand and be a part of it, because these moments don't happen very often. And I think that's one of the things that drew so many people out into the streets, because when's the last time we had something to celebrate that much about? It might be meaningless to a number of us. But, you know, just like the goal that Democratic Republic of Congo scored today, you take what you can get and find joy in the small things, because sometimes those are the most important things. Yeah. Okay, well, another thing that happened, which I thought was kind of funny, was that, you know, after the whole hissy fit that happened last week with Charles Dolan and Madison Square Garden and all that, for those who don't know, he got mad that he didn't get a permit for 10,000 people to have a party outside Madison Square Garden on, I believe it was last Wednesday, a week ago, for Game 4. Yeah, I think that was Game 4 that they were playing. The funny thing is, he never applied for 10,000 a person gathering. He applied for 999, and it was granted. And then he, and this is all documented. This is all, you know, people have seen this. It's been displayed. That's the only thing he filled out, and that's what he got. And he was mad that he got that and didn't get something that he didn't apply for. And so he canceled the watch party that was going to take place outside Madison Square Garden. And by the way, Kyle and I walked by there last time we were inspecting the hotel that Hope is going to be at. We walked by there, and there happened to be a Knicks game being played. We saw how big it was. There couldn't have been more than 1,000 people there. So I'm not sure what he was asking for, where that was going to be, probably surrounding the entire area. The funny thing is that he accused the city of basically hosting a police state, you know, where people were forbidden from being out on the street, which is not what was happening at all. But to hear that from Charles Dolan, of all people, this is the guy that will have you kicked out of Madison Square Garden if you are part of a legal firm that has ever had any kind of legal action against Madison Square Garden, the New York Knicks, the New York Rangers, the Sphere in Las Vegas, Radio City Musical. He owns all of this. You know, it's insane how much this guy owns. And he will have you thrown out because of facial recognition. They will find you in any of these venues. Doesn't matter if you have a ticket. And this is a guy who is claiming that it's a police state outside because he didn't get what he wanted. It's an incredible story. But what happened afterwards was that Mayor Mondani basically commandeered 130 Link NYC kiosks across the five boroughs. Well, he didn't actually commandeer them. He worked with Link NYC and brought the games to, or brought the game to Link NYC kiosks so people could gather around and watch it there, which I thought was really funny and kind of ingenious. He said the Knicks belong to all New Yorkers, whether you're watching from the Garden or not. Earlier this week, New Yorkers gathered around Link NYC kiosk to watch one of the greatest comebacks in basketball history. This weekend, we're running it back. More than 100 kiosks will turn our sidewalks into watch parties and our streets into celebrations. Knicks in five. This is the guy that Charles Dolan said is not a true Knicks fan. Yeah, whatever. This is how you do it. This is you take over technology. You figure out ways to bring it to the people. I'm glad the mayor did it so that hackers didn't have to do it, you know, because I would have been all in favor of this, having something being displayed in, you know, streets all throughout the city. You have these massive screens. Well, let's use them for something good. And that, to me, is a great use of that. Thoughts? Yes, Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't disagree with the fact that I think that that was a particularly ingenious use of Link NYC kiosks that are usually pretty awful. But the whole notion of this, the principle of it, I completely disagree with. I mean, I think this is really dangerous. I think we should be really concerned about the government commandeering and repurposing all of this technology, a kiosk network that's supposed to be built for some kind of neutral civic access. that then begins to be used for state-controlled broadcast channels?
Okay, calm down.
Used by the government? This is exactly what we're talking about.
You are distorting things.
No, I'm not. I'm not distorting things.
Can I quote the CEO?
This is exactly what happened.
Can I quote the CEO of Link NYC? Okay, they know something about their technology.
Go ahead.
It was built to connect New Yorkers to what matters most, and few things have united this city quite like this historic Knicks run. Link NYC and Intersection, not sure what that is, are proud to work with the city to integrate live content into public spaces and transform digital infrastructure into a platform for community, culture, and connection. What do you find problematic in that?
I'll tell you exactly why, and I think you're doing a disservice to our listeners in not bringing this up. Because if it was any other political party or any other politician who was controlling the screens, we would be criticizing them.
That's not true.
When the city,
That's
when
not
the
true
city,
at all.
Emmanuel, it absolutely is. Think about this. It's very Orwellian. If the city or the
it's
government controls.
It's a basketball game, for God's sake. It's not a political speech.
It's a wider issue.
You just when the city so much at anything he
no,
does.
No, I don't.
Well, then say
Emmanuel?
One good thing. Now, it doesn't. Look, if this had
I
been,
just did.
If this had been Cuomo doing this, you would have been bowing down and praising him for doing it.
Are you kidding me? I'm not a fan of the sex pest.
Just because it's Mandani doing it or being involved in it, it really was Lincoln
Emmanuel,
that did it.
Emmanuel, I already said something nice about Mandani. I said I thought it was a particularly ingenious use of these kiosks.
But it's somehow dangerous.
The wrong use. It is extremely dangerous because when the city or the state controls the screens,
they
control what we see.
They
control the
story.
Yes, but they should not be allowed to broadcast any kind of message that they want or to commandeer them at any particular time, at any moment.
They didn't
commandeer
anything. They worked out a deal with Link NYC. What's the issue?
That's commandeering. That's controlling the screens all around the city. If they control what we see, they control the story. If you use it for a sporting event, you can use it for some kind of propaganda event as well.
Tell me the difference between having it on TV where people can watch it on their television set. Is that bad too?
Because you're choosing to watch it. You're not walking past it
people
on the street. There's a big
to
difference.
Watch that. It's on the street. They're choosing to look, just like they're choosing to look on the side of a building where somebody is projecting it. Is that a...
It's
is
an
that
advertisement.
Are you condemning the people who are projecting it onto the sides of buildings? It wasn't Mandani, so I don't think you're going to condemn it.
If you're projecting it on the side of a building, you're doing that as a private citizen. I object to the fact that the government can take over these kiosks and project any message that they want at any particular time.
They did. You're totally distorting this. They did not take it over. They worked it out with Link NYC.
They worked out a deal. They worked out a deal to take over the kiosks.
Not all of them. Not all of them.
What do you think, Rob? I'm curious. As a neutral arbiter in this.
I didn't think this is what we were going to be arguing over, really. This was a good thing that helped calm people down, people who are already in the street. And why do you think they were in the street? You know, just out for a breath of fresh air? They cared about the Knicks. This is a great way for them to be able to see what they want to see. How do you find something bad in that?
Since you asked me, the Link NYC kiosks, for those unfamiliar, these are what popped up where payphones used to be. And the payphones were a public utility, but they were, you know, privately owned and run in contract with the city. Link NYC runs the same way. It's got a bunch of owners. It's part owned by Qualcomm, part owned by Intersection, which is the name of the company. It was a merger between Control Group and Titan. Titan used to run the payphones. And so... The whole thing with them is they have always been an advertising delivery service, and I'm pretty anti-advertising. I think there's way too much of it about out in the world, especially here in the city. And for those, you know, brief moments, I guess I'm not against them being used for this instead of telling people what brand of sneakers they should buy or some crap like that. But I also think that, you know, maybe there's... there have always been concerns since the start of these things being loaded with cameras and these things having all sorts of antennas besides the ones broadcasting their own Wi-Fi network. And so the privacy and security implications of that have always sort of been in question. So them being used for something like this, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. But I'm still not much of a fan of the things as they are.
I think this was a more useful thing than they usually do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like the city runs what's on there, right? It's a project of the city. The city's not coming in and commandeering anything. They're responsible for a lot of the material that's already there. And I think we can all agree that the Link NYC system has kind of, if I could borrow a phrase, gone over like a burp in church. And this was the first really useful thing I can think that they have accomplished, because it allowed people to spread out more and to create 130 small outdoor watch parties around the city for people who are invested in that sort of thing, I think was probably a really good thing. And I think this is a better use than, so much of what's already there.
Go ahead, Alex.
Well, to me, it's the precedential aspect of this. A single use case that is great when the Knicks are winning the playoffs, okay, that's all well and good, that's fine, but we're not talking about a single ad or a single incident or a single alert. Once government begins to claim public technology as its own communications tool, that's when every one of these kiosks can become some kind of policy channel. That's a lot closer to a soft form of control than it is to a public service. And if we allow this to happen over and over and over again, we get used to it, and these things become a communications layer for the government, for the Office of Propaganda, for whatever the hell it is that they're going to be pushing out to us at any particular moment. So I think we should say, okay, this was a great idea. It worked out well. Everybody was partying and watching the game. But let's make sure that it's not abused in the future.
As Gila said, this is already controlled by the city. You see 311 being advertised on there constantly. You see all kinds of public service announcements from the city on Link NYC. Why is the Knicks game the line? I don't get that. This is something that actually was brilliant as far as crowd control and keeping people from being frustrated by not being able to go to the watch party they want to go to or get into the game itself. It's a good use of these things that we always are complaining about. So,
well, I'll tell you why. There's a big difference between running consistent or continuous ads or a subway schedule on the particular platform, and that's a commercial arrangement that is worked out well in advance. That's a lot different than commandeering the network for a particular broadcast of certain types of information. If we allow that to happen, if we allow the mayor's office to continually commandeer these kiosks and broadcast whatever they want to broadcast, whether it's a press release, whether it's some kind of political rally, what if we had Donald Trump broadcasting a Trump rally across these kiosks?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because it's black and white how Trump would do this versus how Mondani would do it. Right, Trump would, in fact, have his face on there preaching to us and basically spreading propaganda and ultimate fighting or whatever else he's into. All kinds of things being forced down our throat, as he has done in many instances. That is not what happened here. This is a game being shared with people in the streets as a public service, which is what these kiosks are supposed to be. And you can say commandeered as much as you want. He did not commandeer anything. He worked out a deal with the company that runs these things. It was a good thing to do. It was a positive thing to do. I'd like to move past it because we have other things to talk about here.
Well, we can disagree. I think the effect was positive. The precedent was bad.
And I think your reach rivals that tall guy in the San Antonio Spurs, and you might want to look into trying out for a team with that.
Very funny.
Yeah, it is.
Very funny.
It's very funny. This is something else that happened over the past few days. The UK has announced a social media ban for children. What are children, you might ask? They are creatures that are 16 years of age or younger. Oh, boy. So we all know that Labour is in a lot of trouble over in the UK, and Keir Starmer, I think, basically is desperate and is trying to get the parents on his side, because most parents seem to support this kind of thing. I think it was 75% are in support of banning social media for kids, as high as 90% I've seen in some polls. Now, Starmer said the government would introduce the new regulations in Parliament before Christmas and bring a ban into force in the early part of 2027. These measures will include restrictions on game platforms and live streaming apps. with more details expected to be announced in the next month. I am not prepared to compromise on the safety and happiness of our children, and that is why this ban must happen. I would ask the children if their happiness is being respected by banning social media for them. Now, what's interesting about this is that what's included in the social media ban, apps like Snapchat, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Yeah, that's right, YouTube. Can you imagine telling your kid you can't watch any YouTube videos? You're banned from YouTube until you turn 16? Messages like WhatsApp and Signal are not going to be included in the restrictions. The government said it also planned to block children under 16 from live streaming and from communicating with strangers on a wider range of online services, including game sites. The government said it would also be looking in more detail at overnight curfews and breaks in infinite scrolling for people under 18. Now, not all parents favor a ban. Some experts have pointed out that most young people with social media accounts in Australia have continued to use the platforms, just despite a ban over there. Others have criticized the announcement as rushed, coming as Mr. Starmer faces threats to his leadership from within his Labor Party after steep losses in local elections in May. What do you guys think about this? Good idea? Bad idea? Rob, go ahead.
I am fascinated by this because, you know, think of the children. Think of the children. Won't somebody think of the children? That's always, always been used as just this way to get people to accept that a new regulation or rule or restriction of some sort is a good idea. But the practicality behind it is really troubling in this situation because you can say it's illegal for children to access this sort of site on the web. But the web is not built like that. The web is built to route around damage, to route around blockage. And I think the end result of this is to try and push for age verification tools, which lead to identity verification tools for everyone sitting in front of the damn net. And age verification tools right now don't work very well. But the fact that they don't work very well now should not be used as a way to just let some sort of implementation of them through, because, you know, one day they will work better and the internet will be screwed up for everyone.
Yeah, thank God they don't work very well, you know?
Yeah.
Can you imagine if they did?
But they will, and the troubling part is, say this succeeds, and say by some magic stroke the age verification thing works perfectly, no mistakes, no errors. Kids will just say, okay, I'm not going to use these big social media sites that everyone's talking about. It's going to drive them deeper into, you know, they'll be on the dark web, they'll be on isolated forums and things in places, like things used to be, which maybe isn't a bad thing, but on the other hand, it's going to drive them to sites that are under less scrutiny. And, you know, I don't think driving kids off of Facebook or Instagram and onto, you know, whatever the next 4chan is perhaps the best idea in the world for their mental health.
Yeah, you know, I don't want kids to be using social media as much as they do. I don't want, you know, adults to be using it as much as they do. I think it's a cancer, something that is really, really hurting us, and we need to address that. This is not the way to address that, by demanding everybody prove how old they are. No, that's a way to get rid of anonymity. And you talk about Big Brother watching us. That is how you achieve that. It's a very, very unhealthy step to take, and it's not the right way to deal with what is, in fact, a problem for many of us. But the other thing to consider is that there are a lot of positive aspects out there on the internet, on social media. You know, marginalized kids who might not realize that there's anybody out there who understands them, who is like them. This is a lifesaver in many regards, and it should not simply be categorized as something that's harmful to people under a certain age. That is incredibly stupid. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's a contrary way to look at this in a way. So, I mean, if you think about this somewhat perversely, right, from our perspective, nothing really protects children more than giving them a gigantic incentive to become better hackers. Right, that's what they're doing. Right, they're telling children, "Hey, you want to get around this idiotic velvet rope that we're putting around a flood?" Right, that like there's just no way you can keep a flood in with a rope. That's what they're trying to do here. But they're going to teach children about VPNs. They're going to force kids to learn about virtual private networks and proxies and routing IP addresses. And they're going to learn about packets and all kinds of fun things when they are circumventing these idiotic laws that the UK are putting in place. And somebody who went to school in the UK, who teaches law in the UK and lived in the UK, I also have to say I am not surprised that the United Kingdom looked at the problem of social media and said, you know what? What if the solution here was actually to create more paperwork? That's kind of what they do. This is the mentality of how they solve problems over there. So it doesn't surprise me in many ways, but I think the forcing kids to learn about the internet and how to circumnavigate these idiotic rules might actually be beneficial in the long run.
Well, yeah, I guess, but it's going to basically teach a lot of kids that this is normal. Having to identify yourself at every level of participation online, anonymity is tantamount to criminality, and it's eventually going to come over here as well. It has already in many regards. We need to fight this. We really need to battle against this because there are a lot of values that are under attack here and a lot of positive aspects that are being disregarded.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I keep thinking about is I've often looked at the modern social media environment that has evolved and how even young people can find their own community, find people like themselves, find information about themselves, and find and exchange this info freely and learn that, say, if you're not hetero, if you're not cisgender, you're not, maybe you're not getting enough support about that in your real life, but you can find online community and realize, hey, there are other people like me out there. Maybe I'm not some kind of freak. And, you know, this is an excellent thing for mental health. A ban like this, and when they start using this to ban sexual education materials or, you know, alternative political philosophies or any other sorts of things that the powers that be might say, oh, no, not for kids. And, yeah. Then those kids are feeling isolated and or they're coming up against this block. And whether or not they read around it, they're being told by the system that what you're interested in or what you are or what you're feeling about yourself is wrong. And that is not how to take care of your children. That is not a way to good mental health.
And let's not mistake what's happening here in many places where parents are basically trying to keep their kids from learning that, hey, being gay is normal, being trans is normal, you know, being different is something to celebrate. And keep them under the control where they can feel shame in all the right places and follow the religion that they are brought up with and everything that parents want their kids to be if they want total control over their minds. So there are a lot of parents who celebrate this kind of thing, who say, yes, finally, little Bobby will be able to be, a normal kid and won't ever learn that there are other kids that, you know, share his perspective that will soon snuff out. It's sickening what you hear sometimes from parents who celebrate this kind of thing. And that is something that we don't want to encourage. We don't want to encourage this kind of thing that I think is a part of it.
Yeah, and I have often said, and damn it, it's Pride Month, and I will say this out loud on the radio, that, growing up as a queer person who I was very, very fortunate to be able to find community and be able to find people I could talk to about this, regardless of whether certain authority figures in my life would have wanted me to be talking about these things or learning these things. That is why I'm here and, you know, able to talk with you now. I don't think I would have survived it had I not been able to find that sort of community. And so, like, anything that, I've looked at generations after me and how much easier this could be for them, and now I'm looking at a generation long after me thinking, oh, it's about to get worse.
Mm-hmm. Alex, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest issues I have with any types of age verification laws is that they tend to corral everybody into some kind of centralized system. And if you're building a system that is designed to keep children out, you're also building a system that logs everything and can log you in and log you out as well. So in the name of protecting children, we wind up surveilling adults. none of it works particularly well. It all seems really idiotic. And if you look at the cost-benefit analysis that we have here, and I don't necessarily agree with the premise that, you know, social media has all of these positive benefits. I know that people find community and various things in social media platforms. I do think, you know, we shouldn't discount the real-world harm that comes from a lot of these, you know, these unlimited scrolling, attention-grabbing, identity-sorting, tribal kind of politics that kids are subjected to on social media platforms. I do think, on balance, they do more harm than good. I think if we had more federated, more decentralized social media places that were beyond the centralized control of either one company or one particular government, like the internet is supposed to work, goddammit, then I think we'd all be better off and we'd be able to find these communities where we can support each other more easily and without having this type of dating function that winds up doing a lot more harm than good.
God's sake, Alex.
What is this?
Close your damn window.
this is Manhattan, man. What do you expect? You know, this is, I'm surprised you could hear it. I thought the noise canceling would be more effective, but I guess not.
They could hear that in Jersey. Come on. Look, I disagree with one thing, though. You say it doesn't work particularly well. I think it does work all too well. I think, you know, it doesn't work to achieve the desired effect of keeping kids safer, but it works brilliantly as far as keeping track of all of us, who we are, what our politics are, you know, where we live, what our ages, all these things that we have the right to keep to ourselves. But if we're told over and over again, no, this is something that you no longer have the right to keep private and you must reveal all this information, a lot of people aren't going to object. A lot of people aren't going to know they can fight back against this sort of thing. And, you know, we're here to tell them that is not true. You have every right to be private. You have every right to be anonymous. It's not a bad thing. It's a healthy thing. Yes, people use it for evil. People use it for all kinds of nefarious purposes. That doesn't make the desire to be anonymous any less of a good desire. You know, there are so many places where I am not who I am on my birth certificate, and that's fine. It doesn't cause any problems. Is it a problem if somebody is constantly online and subjected to algorithms directing them to all sorts of unhealthy things? Of course, that is what we should be attacking. What if we attack the algorithms, not the ages so much? Make it so that things are more like Mastodon, where there isn't an algorithm, and work with that. Imagine if every kid under 16 or under 18, not that I'm buying into this, could only use Mastodon and became an expert on how that worked. And by the time they got to Facebook age, they didn't want it anymore because they had lived their lives with something better. How about we all live with something better? Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, I mean, think back to this. This wouldn't have ever worked on BBSs, right? I mean, because they all ran on individual people's computers. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd have to get into every single BBS's hard drive and find them all. And, you know, I take your point.
Don't think there weren't people who wanted control over that, who wanted every single BBS to log who was connecting to it, their ages, get a copy of their license, et cetera, et cetera. There are always people who want that level of control, and it never is the right thing. Okay, what is this crazy story that I've been seeing, Kyle, about Peter Thiel's secretive dialogue society? Information on them being leaked. According to Wired, a trove of internal records from a secret society for powerful figures in U.S. politics, finance, and tech was left exposed online, according to Wired, naming participants in its events and revealing sensitive personal details they were assured would stay private. Wow, you're foolish. The group is called Dialogue, if you can believe it. Or not yet. Yeah, that's a great name to have for a group that no one apparently had before. It's a private invitation-only organization co-founded in 2006 by the billionaire tech investor Peter Thiel. It convenes U.S. officials, foreign government figures, Silicon Valley executives at off-the-record annual retreats. Dialogue has spent two decades declining to disclose its members. Well, those two decades apparently are over because its members have been exposed. A directory in the website's code was first revealed by the Swiss hacktivist Maya Arsen Krimiu, and I'm probably pronouncing that really badly, known for exposing the U.S. government's no-fly list and breaching the surveillance camera company Verkada. Crime U tells Wired the directory surfaced via an anonymous F